Hello and welcome to this episode of Epochs, where, as promised, I'll be talking all about the Medici family. So it will be a bit of an overview episode, a bit of a sweeping one, because it's about 300 odd years of history. And I won't be able to talk about every single member of the family of any note. I'll only really be able to hit the highlights. So if I miss out ones that you find particularly interesting, I can only apologise, but I shall try and do all the most important ones. Okay, so let's dive straight in. So the person that a lot of historians usually say is the founder, in inverted commas, of the dynasty, he's not the first Medici, but the first really, really important one, is Giovanni de' Bicchi de' Medici. And already by this point, the Medici family, the Medici bank, is already established. They're very, very, very rich. But it's under this Giovanni that it becomes kind of super rich. And here we're talking the early 15th century. Just the turn of the 15th century into the 1420s. In fact, it's by 1421 that this first of the Giovanni Medici's, or firstly to say, there are lots of Giovannis, lots of Pieros, more than one Lorenzo. So I have to make it clear, more than one Cosimo, I have to make it clear which one I'm talking about. But this first, most important Giovanni, he actually seems that he didn't actually want to be involved in politics, in sort of the dirty game of Florentine politics all that much. But the family became so rich and powerful and influential that they just sort of, it was almost foisted upon him. He almost couldn't avoid it. In 1421, he was voted gonfalonier, i.e. the sort of titular nominal head of Florence. And as I say, the Medici fortune kind of explodes under him. Some have said that if you adjust for inflation, they would have had maybe something in the order of $1 trillion in modern money. You know, richer than anyone alive today, richer than Elon Musk, by a long way. Perhaps the richest people that have ever lived, and the Medici family only become richer. It seems that this Giovanni Bicchi, I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly, it seemed that he was a great financier. He absolutely knew the business of banking inside out, and you can't say that for a lot of the Medicis to come. He was something like a financial wizard. Like, he could make up new things, new techniques, new vehicles for making money. And it's under him that the Medici Bank spread its business across Europe, that they opened up branches in Rome, in Naples, in Venice, in France. And perhaps it's under this first Giovanni that the Medici family get their first real massive break, a massive, massive break. Because remember, the Medici family are not royal, not yet. The family comes from Mugello in Italy, and they're certainly not royal. And yet later generations of the Medicis do become dukes, and even there's, and popes, and there's even the odd Queen of France in there, which we'll get to. And so it's very difficult, particularly in the Middle Ages, isn't it? It's extremely difficult to break through that glass ceiling of being, even if you're extremely rich, of going from unlanded and unroyal, without noble blue blood, to being thought of as though you do have blue blood. That's extremely difficult. One of the big breaks, it never happened in Giovanni's life, but the big break they got to go from merely super rich to starting playing with the great powers of Europe is that Giovanni got the account, so to speak, for the papacy. He was able to become the actual banker, in inverted commas, the accountant, perhaps you could say, for the popes. Now that's massive. All great banking families would have coveted that position, of course, because it places you above any of the other great banking financier families in terms of prestige, let alone in terms of just pure money going through your accounts. Now there was a Pope, John XXIII, and he's thought of as an anti-pope. I don't want to get into all the details because it is a bit confusing, but in the early 15th century, there were Avignon popes. There was more than one pope running around, some in France, in Avignon. And this Pope John XXIII was one of those. He was actually the pope that called the Council of Constance, which settled who should be the real pope. And they settled on somebody else, Martin V. But Giovanni Bicchi de' Medici had backed John XXIII, had bankrolled him. And in return for this, John XXIII had given the Medici family the account for the papacy. And then when Martin V became Pope, he continued it on. So the Medici Bank now becomes, in all sorts of ways, the preeminent bank in the whole of Europe, certainly in Italy. The Medici family become the preeminent financiers in the Western world, you might say. And during this time, and this trend only increases, the amount of money, the amount of revenues that is passing through St. Peter's, passing through the hands of the Pope, so to speak, it just keeps going up. Lots and lots of gold and money from the New World, from Spanish and Portuguese holdings in the New World, finds its way to Italy and the Pope. And under Medici popes, which I'll get to shortly, the explosion of indulgences and much, much more money going through the papacy. Of course, all this sort of thing also will garner you lots of enemies. People will get jealous. It seems you don't really need hardly any success in life before you start gathering jealous enemies. And of course, Giovanni Medici garnered lots of enemies, political ones in Florence, if nothing else. And he also set the tone for a lot of later Medicis in terms of patronage, in terms of the amount of art and architecture that he commissioned. Eventually, of course, he died. So after Giovanni came his son Cosimo, Cosimo the Elder. Again, not to be confused with a later Cosimo the First, a Grand Duke, a lot later. He commissioned lots of buildings, various churches. Florence is filled with churches. Lots of paintings and sculpture. Some of the early greats before the age of Michelangelo, like Angelico and Lippi and Donatello. He was a great lover of the ancient world. And that is really what the Renaissance is, isn't it? As I said before, the rebirth of classicism. This idea of looking back at the ancient world, seeing how stupendously great it was. And, you know, can't we recreate that or even better it in all sorts of ways? And he just spent a lot of his wealth on making Florence better or grander or more beautiful. He commissioned a great library along with churches. He helped commission the Duomo, or paid a lot of money for the Duomo, the great biggest cathedral in Florence. Towards the end of his life, he is made Duke of Ferrara. And at one point he was exiled just for 1 year, but then he came back. As I mentioned before, Florence had this system of running through their officials very quickly, that quite often you'd only have 10 years of a few months. And so the political winds could change quite quickly. Somebody could be completely out of favour and exiled or even arrested. And within months or within 1 year, they're completely restored. All their political favours are all returned to them. And it was under Cosimo the Elder that the dome of the great cathedral in Florence, the Duomo, was built. It hadn't had the dome finished on it for years and years and years. It had been built too big, really, and no one really knew how to exactly build such a giant dome and have it not collapse. Eventually, Cosimo the Elder takes a punt on Brunelleschi, Brunelleschi's sort of secret idea of how he's going to construct this dome. And anyway, long story short, without talking about Brunelleschi for a long time, it was completed. Now, Florence, the city of Florence, the people of Florence were absolutely over the moon with Cosimo, that he'd had the dome completed. And that cemented the Medici family, really, in all sorts of ways, in the hearts of the Florentine people. One of the interesting things Cosimo the Elder had said is that he really should have started spending the family's fortune on art, the patronage of art and architecture and building, 10 years earlier than he did. He really did think that there was no better way to spend his money. If you want to win the hearts and soul of the people, you really need to spend a lot of your money on the city and on them, in effect. I suppose one of the last important things to say, just to press home his sort of financial acumen, is that he struck all sorts of deals that had never really been done before, loaning lots of money, becoming a type of loan shark, for want of a better word. The practice of loaning people lots of money in return for other financial favours. If you're a great importer or exporter, he will loan you money at a low rate of interest, and in return, he should be able to buy and sell goods from you at a discount, at a great rate. You know, money breeds money. Eventually, of course, he died, and the next great Medici that came along was Piero the Gouty. I mentioned him in passing, just in passing, because he doesn't rule for all that long. And as his nickname, the Gouty, suggests, he was a bit overweight and not in great health. He eventually, well, he died of lung disease, we think, in the end. It's always difficult to diagnose what people in the past died from, unless it's absolutely obvious. But it looks like he had some sort of lung disease. He was in his late 40s, I believe. But he was thought of as a safe pair of hands. He didn't tank anything during his tenure at the head of the Medici family. And then the head of the family passed to his son, Lorenzo. And this is Lorenzo the Magnificent. And I've talked a fair bit about Lorenzo the Magnificent before, so I won't go into sort of crazy detail. He's one of the Medicis that if you wanted to, you could talk for hours and hours and hours about him. But seeing as I've done a fair bit on him, when I talked about Leonardo, Michelangelo and Savonarola, I won't do a crazy amount of detail. But the important thing, one of the most important things I think about Lorenzo the Magnificent, is that his education. He was the first great Medici, let's say, to be raised to be a type of scholar, that before he was even born, his family knew that this child, or whoever was going to inherit the household, would have to be a statesman and a diplomat, not just a banker. And so he was raised the way an actual Italian prince in the 15th century would have been raised, i.e. to be a type of scholar, to be cultured, to be extremely well-read, to have an eye for art, to understand the classics, to understand sort of grand economics beyond just simply banking, but, you know, grander economic trends, to understand all of European politics, really. And not just to understand it, but to be able to play it well. To be an effective diplomat, none of the Medicis before him were raised from childhood to be a statesman and an economist and a diplomat and a scholar and a classicist. And he was. It seems Lorenzo the Magnificent understood Florentine politics absolutely inside out. He was able to play the game of Florentine politics very, very well. And yet he inherited his position quite young. He was only like 20 years old. As I say, his father, Piero de' Gaudi, died before he became an old man. So Lorenzo was only about 20. So that is very young. Very, very young. I wouldn't have been able to handle such a mantle when I was 20, I don't think. Certainly wouldn't have been able to play my hand deftly. And Lorenzo, at first, we're told, all the accounts seem to agree, that he took it on reluctantly, you know, because at that point, becoming the head of the Medici household and then, you know, by default, becoming one of the most important people in Europe and probably the richest person in all of Europe, that's quite a lot of responsibility. Your childhood is over. There's no room now for any childish things. You are absolutely fully 100% in the world of men. Not only that, but it's gone a bit beyond having merely jealous enemies. You've got deadly enemies now. There'll be all sorts of people and factions that want you dead. In fact, Piero de' Gaudi had had an assassination attempt against him, which he only narrowly avoided. And Lorenzo the Magnificent learnt a lot of lessons from his grandfather, Cosimo the Elder. He also spent a great deal of time and money on the patronage of the arts. Again, I won't go into Michelangelo and Leonardo and Raphael all that much. I've already told those stories. But one thing to say, I suppose, is that he had a great eye, personally. His word could make or break the career of an artist. And, you know, those famous gardens that became a type of school for sculptors, at least. Now, the family bank under Lorenzo the Magnificent, some say that it was under Cosimo or under Lorenzo the Magnificent that the Medici family hit the heights of their personal wealth. Some have said that it became crazy how much money they had, that if you tried to account for inflation, it would be more than all the money in the world, which obviously doesn't make sense, but that the numbers were just astronomical. They didn't necessarily actually have all the money. There's this idea of liquidity, is that you could be worth billions. Someone like Warren Buffett or Bill Gates or Elon Musk, their net worth on paper is billions or tens of billions, but they don't actually have tens of billions of dollars in the bank or in bullion in a vault somewhere, in a Scrooge McDuck vault. It's on paper, right? So people owe them that money, or the things that they own, if they liquidated them, if they sold them, would add up to that amount. You don't necessarily actually have the cash, right? That's why Roman Abramovich is so powerful and wealthy because a lot of his money is liquid. He actually has the cash sitting there ready to spend. It seems that the Medici Bank had began to have some liquidity problems. On paper, they had astronomical amounts of money and wealth. In reality, though still extremely rich with a giant fund, they had nowhere near the amount of money they really should have had, if that makes sense. I mean, basically, people say that Lorenzo the Magnificent took his eye off the ball, so to speak. He didn't pay a great deal of attention to the banking side of the family. He sort of let others do it who might not have been the greatest. They weren't sort of financial wizards the way that Giovanni Bicchi had been or the way that Cosimo the Elder had been. Lorenzo preferred to spend his time sort of ruling, in inverted commas, ruling by proxy and enjoying himself, enjoying Florence and the arts and being a socialite. And he married very, very well. He married into nobility. And so again, that you can see this sort of trajectory of the Medici family still just going up and up and up. He married Clarice Orsini and the Orsini family from Rome, an extremely important family. A few of them became popes themselves. So he married very, very well. I mean, it's under Lorenzo the Magnificent that the florin first sort of comes around. That is different places in Europe in the Middle Ages. You could mint your own coins if you were rich and powerful enough. Florence starts minting its own currency, the florin. Florin, you can say. And it was sort of the Medici family's, the confidence in the Medici family was so high that the florin became one of the greatest coins in Europe. Now, I must touch upon probably the most important event, single event in Lorenzo's life, which was when he and his brother Giuliano were ambushed on Easter inside the Duomo in Florence. Lorenzo had lots of enemies, least of all the Pazzi family, the other great, even more noble family from Florence. They wanted the Medici's out of the way. Pazzi family really thought that they should be controlling Florence. They are the preeminent family in Florence and had been in centuries past, and that the Medici's had usurped them. And the best way to reverse that trend was to murder Giuliano and Lorenzo. And it seems, it's a bit murky, but it does seem that the church were in on it as well. Or, well, they sort of must have been to some extent. And as we know, they were both stabbed. Giuliano was killed, stabbed 20 plus times and died on the spot. Lorenzo got stabbed in the neck. I think he got stabbed 2 or 3 or 4 times, one time in the neck. But obviously not enough to kill him or even maim him. And he got away, but in the immediate hours afterwards, people weren't sure whether they both were dead because Lorenzo literally ran for his life and, you know, could easily bleed out any sort of cut in the neck. If you could quite easily bleed out. So for a few hours, there's just complete confusion in Florence. Nobody's sure if both the brothers had died. Eventually, later that evening, Lorenzo shows himself to the people. And at that point, his faction, the Medici faction, realising that they've still got a leader, kind of go berserk and take their vengeance on all the conspirators, lots of the Pazzi family and people, important people in the church, and anyone else who was thought to be involved was sort of rounded up, beaten to death, strung up, basically in the Medici revenge played out. And from that point onwards, Lorenzo held the reins of power very tightly. He realised, you know, you've got a bull by the horns, you've got a tiger by the ears here. You can't muck about. You need to make sure that your personal safety is taken care of at all times. And it's actually prudent to keep all your political enemies down. You can't be Mr. Nice Guy anymore. That doesn't get you anywhere in 15th century Florence. But having said that, Lorenzo was no tyrant. As I talked about, if you remember, in the Savonarola one, the last episode, he was actually extremely clement. He was far from a tyrant. He wasn't going around insisting that people inform on each other. He didn't have dungeons filled with his enemies, far from it. He was very, very forgiving. He was sort of the lightest touch, in a way, for a ruler, for an autocrat. Remember, Florence is still nominally, on paper, a republic. Lorenzo the Magnificent is not the Duke of Florence. He's not the King of Florence in any way. All his powers are informal. and he liked to keep it that way. These first few Medicis, they play the trick, it's not, maybe not fair really to call it a trick, but they played the trick, the card that Augustus played. That is to say that you let all the machinery of government continue as it is. The real power, and everyone knows, it's not a secret, the real power lies with you, i.e. Augustus or Lorenzo the Magnificent or Cosimo the Elder. Everyone knows you've got the power. You're calling all the shots. When there's any big political decisions to be made, you make them and everyone carries out your orders. But it's all informal. Formally, all the machinery of state and government stays exactly as it is. Now, that's like a pressure valve. That allows people to live the lie that you're not an autocrat, that you haven't dominated them politically. It's the lesson that Julius Caesar didn't learn. Julius Caesar sort of formally made himself a dictator, a king in all but name, and there was no real release valve, and so he got himself assassinated. Even then, you're probably still going to have assassination attempts and garner all sorts of jealousies and enemies, but it's just not going to be as bad as if you sort of formally, legally put your foot on everyone's neck. And anyway, that's how the first Medicis decided to do it. Sort of a soft power. I don't really like that term particularly, but Lorenzo the Magnificent certainly exercised a type of soft power. But with the assassination attempt, just to go back to that for a moment, it seems that the church and the Pope were in on it. They sort of had to be. And there's an episode where Lorenzo goes to Rome to try and smooth things over with the Pope. And that was extremely dangerous. He could have easily found himself disappeared, found himself in a papal dungeon, never to see the light of day again. But as I said earlier, Lorenzo was sort of a good politician, for want of a better word, a statesman, a diplomat, however you want to say it. And he does sort of strike a deal with the popes. Actually, interestingly, the Pope himself didn't want to strike a deal, but the power faction around the Pope, with all his sort of leading cardinals, the men that the Pope needed the goodwill of, they wanted to strike a deal with Florence and with Lorenzo and the Medici family in Florence. And so a deal was struck. And so Lorenzo and Florence, sort of just about by the skin of their teeth, delivered themselves from the out-and-out rage of the Pope and perhaps even papal armies turning up at the doorstep of Florence. And, well, at this point, the popularity of the Medici family, after that political coup, the popularity of the Medici family in Florence is sort of at an all-time high. Despite assassination attempts, Lorenzo, it seems, was sort of fairly deeply loved and admired by most Florentines. He was making their city great again. Now, if you're going to plot the fortunes, political fortunes, on a chart of the Medici family, you could argue that Lorenzo the Magnificent sort of reaches the high point. I would say there's probably two peaks, and one of them is Lorenzo the Magnificent. Because after he dies, as I chronicled in the last episode all about Savonarola, that kind of as soon as he dies, there's some real problems in Florence. And I won't go into any detail, I will point you to the last episode. But just to mention, there's Piero the Unlucky, or Piero the Unfortunate, who only rules for a couple of years. And then you've got the interregnum era in Florence, where there are no Medici. You've got Savonarola, and then you've got the great days of the Republic, largely under Soderini and Machiavelli. And this is really, that really is, I would say, the golden age of Florence, where Michelangelo does all his best work and that kind of thing. So the Medici family are out of favour in Florence for quite a while, 20-odd years, nearly 20 years. And the children of Lorenzo and Giuliano are both out of favour. They're both in the church, and these boys, cousins, are Giovanni and Giulio, and they were both in the church. I mean, Giovanni was made a cardinal by the time he was about 16, which is crazy, really, but it was all to do with money and patronage and power and influence and backroom deals. But made a cardinal by the time he's about 16, and Giuliano also was ordained very young. And in the end, Giovanni is elected Pope, and he becomes Pope Leo X. Now, Pope Leo X is an extremely important pivotal pope, the first Medici pope. And when he returns to Florence, they accept him with open arms because it would be he was the first man from Florence to become Pope.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.